obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
David had dibs on me, Mom. He raised his hand first, and I don't know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm eternally grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got a text from my son's mom. She said, "Don't fuck it up," and she's always nice touch, right? You know, and I'm really nervous. I get crazy when I do this. I don't know. I think I've walked around the hotel like four times. You know. My sponsor says it's self-centeredness, but I want to welcome the newcomer at Alcoholics Anonymous and let you know that the way you're feeling right now, you don't ever have to feel that way again. You know, as long as you're willing to do a few simple things around Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, and not knowing that I suffered from the disease of alcoholism. You know, if you looked at my life, you'd just say, "Man, if you just get off the heroin, your life would be good." You know. And I'd come to AA, and I would identify as an addict, you know, and at least where I was going to meetings, you don't want to do that, you know what I mean? I'd say, "My name is Pat, I'm an addict," and people would be like, "Rrr, rrr, rrr, rrr." Yeah, I mean, it's like, let's get the addict out of our room, you know? And I would get pissed off, and I would leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd slam the door, and I wanted you guys to know how angry I was, you know? And no one ever followed me out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, "Hey, kid, why don't we sit down and read the big book? You might suffer from alcoholism not knowing that you're dying from the disease of alcoholism." And I'd leave AA because I didn't know what alcoholism was. You know, and I'd leave AA and I'd say, "I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to use." And I'd make that solemn oath. And I'd promise myself with every bit of inside of me, I didn't want to drink or use. And I'd walk in the liquor store, and I'd get a pack of cigarettes, and I'd walk out with a pint of tequila. And I'd say, "Alcohol's not my problem." And I'd take that top off, and I'd throw it down, and I'd put that bottle back, and I'd be off to the races again. And I'd come to AA because the heat was on, you know. And I'd say, I hear people say their names, such and such, and they're alcoholic and addicts. And I'm like, there's the loophole, you know. And so I'd say, "My name is Pat, I'm an alcoholic and an addict," and someone from across the room would say, "Put $2 in the basket," you know, and you know, I'd be like, "Oh, screw you people in AA, you know." And thank God, like, I don't have to put a buck for every sickness I have, and I'd be broke, you know what I mean? Longer I've stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more it popped up, you know. And I'd leave Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd slam the door because I wanted you to know how pissed off I was. Because I didn't know what alcoholism was. And I can tell you that I suffered from alcoholism long before I ever took my first drink. I suffered from the spiritual malady that alcoholism is. You know, and I grew up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom brought me to AA. I mean, my first memory, I remember being at a church with these other kids that were in AA. Their parents brought them to AA too, and we stole the sugar packets. You know what I mean? And we're outside, and I'm like taking off like 15 sugar packets and sucking those things down, you know? And then we'd run around AA. You know, and no one ever told me, like, "Can you keep your kid?" You know, I didn't ever hear someone tell me to be quiet. You know, I just run around and they'd tell me, "We're saving this seat right here for you." You know, freaking had no clue what they were talking about. You know, I do now. And, you know, and we'd run around AA and the speaker meeting would go off and some guy would fall out of his chair and start flopping around and me and my friends would laugh at him. "Oh, look at that guy over there," you know. And now I know that guy was, you know, withdrawing from alcohol and going into seizures. But I saw what alcoholism did. My mom would bring women home and they'd sleep on our couch and they'd be broken, you know, and we'd go to AA meetings, you know. I'd be sitting out there where you guys are and I could recite chapter 5 and I could recite the 12 traditions. I held everyone's hands. I'm like, "Keep coming back," you know. And, you know, and all of a sudden these women's lives would get good, you know. I remember the women in AA would be like, "Oh my God, he's so cute. Can I have him for the weekend?" My mom's like, "Sure, go ahead," you know. And off whitewater rafting I go with the women in AA, or off to San Francisco I go, you know. You know, and I met some of these women today, and, you know, I wouldn't, I have a six-year-old, I wouldn't let him go home with most of you, you know what I mean? AA was different that, you know, all those years ago, I guess. But if knowledge had anything to do with alcoholism, I'd have never taken my first drink, right? I saw what the disease of alcoholism did, you know? If love had anything to do with alcoholism, I'd have never taken my first drink. I mean, the love that I feel in this room is the love that I was raised with. You know, but my mom being a blackout drinker, I mean, she just threw herself under the bus. Usually I do it for her, you know, but I mean, she didn't even know I was around, alive until she was 11 months old, you know. Well, I'm guessing she probably doesn't know who my dad is either, you know. But I can tell you as a small kid, like, as a small kid, that wasn't funny. You know what I mean? As a little kid, you know, I'd see you playing catch with your parents, you know, and I wonder what it was like to play catch with my dad, you know? And I always had this big, deep emptiness on the inside. You know, my mom put me in sports, you know, she put me in basketball, she put me in AYSO soccer, which I hated, you know what I mean? I suffer from laziness, too, you know what I mean? You have to run a lot in soccer, you know? And I got mad at the soccer mom because she was handing out oranges, and I got one quarter of an orange. You know what I mean? Can I have more? She's like, no, you know. So I was over soccer. I played basketball. One time I jumped up. I caught the ball. I was so excited to get the ball, and I threw it back in the basket, and it was the wrong hoop, you know. And and all my friends on my team are like, you're an idiot, you know. I mean, they weren't saying that, but that's what I was thinking. Idiot, loser, failure. You know, my mom put me in baseball, you know. I was like the kid in right field, you know, the kid in right field, you know. The awkward kid, you know what I mean? It's like, and I'm out in right field, you know. I'm not like the son, I'm not the coach's son. He's pitching, you know, every inning, you know. I'm the kid in right field, you know. It's like his parents paid for it, so he might as well give him a couple innings, you know. And I'm out in right field, awkward as all heck, you know. I'm looking for the long grass thing with the white thing on there, you know what I mean? I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm like, I don't know where I am, but I hear the coach saying, the other side of the field, kid. You know, I'm in left field. You know, and I was just absolutely terrified. I was totally afraid of everything. I remember being on second base one time, just standing there like, oh, my God, what do I do? You know. And the kid, all of a sudden, he cracked a line drive, and I ran back to first base, you know, and it was a triple play, you know what I mean? It was like all of a sudden, you know, little poopy pants to the dugout. And all the guys on my team were walking out, you know, loser, failure. You ruined it again. You know, and they weren't saying that, but that's what I was hearing in my head. And I looked at my mom, and she was standing in the stand, and she's like clapping, like, oh, my God, you know. Right? And not clapping because her son got a triple out, you know, but proud because her son was playing the game of baseball. And I remember looking at my mom that day saying, if I only had a dad, that had never happened. You know, and I could tell you that I suffered from the spiritual malady long before I ever took my first drink. I remember I was 9 years old. I was at an AA meeting with these other, you know, the other kids that went to AA with their parents, you know, and we were running around the hospital Saturday night. It was in Laguna Beach. And I remember we were in the parking structure, like in the stairwell, and these kids pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo. And I was 9 years old. And I wasn't like, oh, yeah, this is going to be the solution to the problem. But I remember that bottle going around. I remember telling myself, you better hold it down. Maybe that wasn't my exact words, but it was, you better drink. I remember the bottle going around. I took a big old pull off that bottle. And I don't know what it was like the first time you drank tequila, but I thought it was disgusting. I spit that stuff all out. You know, all over those kids' feet. You know, and my biggest fear is what you think of me. And I was absolutely terrified because I knew I wasn't going to be like the rest of my life. Bottle went back around. I remember telling myself, hold it down, hold it down. I was so excited just to hold it down, you know. I wanted to be a part of those kids. The bottle went around. I took a pull off that bottle and I held it down. And I can tell you that the effect that alcohol has on this alcoholic was all that fear went away. That voice that said, you're no good, you're a failure, you're a loser, all of a sudden got real quiet. You know, and I'm not an alcoholic that's going to come here and say, oh, alcohol stopped working. Not my story. You know? And I didn't run off to Skid Row at nine years old, you know? a little hard getting alcohol in a sober mom's house. You know, can't get booze there. I mean, but all my friends would steal booze, and they'd pour like 6 or 7 different kinds of alcohol in one big pitcher, and then we'd meet at the park, and then we'd pour all those pitchers in one big cooler-like thing, you know, and we just all bring a cup, you know, and just drink that stuff, you know, and we weren't drinking for taste; we were drinking for effect, you know. And by the time I was in high school, we bought the local homeless man a pager, you know, and. We just beep him, you know what I mean? Dude would come strolling up, rah, rah, you know. We'd buy him a pint of booze, and he'd buy us enough alcohol for the day, you know. And started to get more resourceful as time went on. You know? And at that time, they were the music, right? Like CDs or mixtapes, I think. Maybe it's tapes, I think. But on the cassette tape, they put this little sticker on there that said parental advisory, right? Warning. And all that, we couldn't buy that music. You know, I was like, why can't we buy this stuff? You know, and they're like, because it's influential. You know, and we're listening to like Eazy-E, N.W.A., Ice Cube. You know, and we're like, influential? What are you talking about? I got size 50 Dickies pulled all the way up. You know what I mean? 5XL sweatshirts, and we got the walk and everything. You know what I mean? I'm like, what do you mean being influenced? You know? I'm drinking Colt 45 out of a brown paper bag. That's what gangsters drink. You know? I'm pouring beer in the curb for the dead homies, you know. Now, I grew up in Mission Viejo. We know there ain't no gangsters in Mission Viejo, you know what I mean? You know, we're getting ready for some dead homies, though, you know. And, you know, I remember going on the way to get a root canal on the bus, sitting in the back of the bus where gangsters sit, you know, drinking Colt 45, 9 a.m. in the morning, you know. And I reached my hand in my pocket, and I pulled out 4 hits of LSD. And I looked at my friend. I'm like, hey, man, you want to eat these things? Now I'm on my way to get a root canal. I didn't think twice, man. I said, you want to eat these? He's like, yeah, let's go. Hour before I was sitting in the chair, you know what I mean? And I remember sitting in the chair, and the tools kind of started. You know, the dentist looked at me. He's like, you want strawberry or banana? I'm like, I don't care. Just give me that mask, you know? We all know it's in that mask. You know, I'm always going for more. You know what I mean? I didn't know that day. I'm like, well, I'm going to be going to AA. Only drink alcohol. You know. All of a sudden, I looked at the dentist. I'm like, hey, dude. I go, you need to turn the nitrous level up and the oxygen level off. And he looked at me kind of like, huh? And I'm thinking in my head, dude, we just stole your tank last week, dude. You know, and that's just how it was. More is better. I that's how it is. Came out of that root canal, this big old stuffed animal lion was huge. It was like chasing out after me, and I'm just laughing, you know. Shortly after that, me and my friends had a great idea, was to get pizza. It was like, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night. And Friday night was jump night in the park. And what that consisted of is you're there with your homies, and all of a sudden your homies call your name. And if your name gets called, all your homies jump you. And they beat you up. You know what I mean? And I'm always the little guy. You know what I mean? I got a big bark, really no bite, you know? I got big friends. Really. I'm just a coward. It's really what I am, you know? But I got scared, man, so I went and got a stun gun. It was Friday night, jump night in the park, and they called my last name. I started zapping my friends, you know? And you know what I mean? And that night, these guys wanted to get pizza. We all reached our hands in our pockets. We didn't have any money. So we got the pizza blocked down from where we were, and one guy grabbed the pizza, one guy handed him leaves for the money, and the third guy took the stun gun and zapped him. Bang! You know, dude goes down. They took off. We ate the pizza, drank our Colt 45, you know. Nothing happened. Next day I go to school. I go to school, and I get a call slip to go to the office. And I don't know about you guys, but I always get a call slip. I'm always up in the office. I'm the kid, man, that's like, man, you have such potential. If you just apply yourself, you could do good things, you know? And I'm, potential, you know? I'm living on that potential. Yeah, one day I'll be something, you know? And I show up to the principal's office, and there's two detectives and a sheriff. And they want to know about this strong-arm robbery case, right? And my biggest fear is what you think of me. I'm not going to be a rat. Gangsters don't rat. So they want to know who did it. And they said, well, we have your name. So I ended up getting a strong-arm robbery case at 16 years old. Whatever. Doesn't make me alcoholic. Just the progression of my disease at 16. I went and did some time in juvenile hall, and then I was on house arrest. And my little gangster friends brought me a little needle with some thread. So I gave myself a tattoo. I gave myself three little dots on my ankle because I had a crazy life in Mission Viejo. And, and then they started healing, man. I realized I'm not really not that crazy. So I flicked one off, you know, and I got two dots now. And, you know, pathetic, you know what I mean? Shortly after that, my mom found a bag of weed in the house, and she's like, hey, man, you can't have this stuff in the house. She said, if you want to get high, that's fine. Want to be sober, that's fine. But you can't be here and get loaded. And so I don't know about you, but the rules don't apply to me. So I just decided to hide it better. You know, and I'm coming home in black. I'm already blacking out at 14, 13. I come out of a blackout one time. My pants are on my ankles. I'm peeing on my mom's fish tank, you know. And I came home one night in that condition, you know. The top lock was locked, and I had to ring the doorbell. My mom came to the door, you know. And my mom was crying. And what I heard my mom say that night, she said, I told you if I found this stuff in the house again, I was going to kick you out. And she said, I'm not lying. You got to go. And I walked in my room that night, and I packed a bag at 17 years old. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned that I have a perception problem. But what my mom said to me that night, she said, you could either be here and be sober, or go out there and get loaded. And I made a choice that night. When I put alcohol in my body, I lose the power to choose. I didn't make a choice that night. I was damned to do what alcohol was going to tell me to do. And I walked in my room, and I packed a bag at 17 years old, and I left the house. And I'd be homeless till the age from age 17 till I got sober at 27 years old. You know. And need to get into all that craziness, but I can tell you a couple things in that time. You know, my mom sent me away. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was getting sent away to camp, right? YMCA camp. And I was like a camper. Then I was a camp counselor in training. And then I was a counselor. Then I was assistant director. Then I was a director, homeless, drinking and using drugs on a daily basis. I show up to camp one day at Catalina Island, right? They didn't invite me back. I just showed up. Hey, here I am. My great idea was I was going to show up to camp and withdraw from heroin, you know? At a high school camp, right? That was a great idea I had. And I got to the camp, and the director looked at me and said, we know what you're doing. You got to get on that boat and get home. Get on the other side. And I got to the mainland. I called my mom, and I said, man, I got to go to treatment, you know? And so my mom took me to Betty Ford. You know, she wanted the best treatment for her son. And I go, and I don't have a problem with treatment at all. I mean, if you went to Betty Ford, you wouldn't have a problem with it either. I mean, they did your laundry for you, prime rib on Sundays. I mean, it was nice, you know. I guess I had one problem. I wasn't allowed to fraternize. And I didn't know what fraternizing meant. I had to ask, you know, what is fraternizing meant? So they explained it to me. I wasn't allowed to talk to the girls, and the girls weren't allowed to talk to me. I don't know how that impacts you if you're new, but it impacted me, you know. But I'm going to follow the rules, you know, and I'm in the infirmary getting my meds because I'm withdrawing from heroin. And I look across the infirmary, and there she is. You know what I mean? And my eyes locked with her eyes. You know what I mean? It's like slow motion movie. Da-na-na. You know, music was going. And I wasn't allowed to talk to her, so I wrote her a note that night. And the guys walked around the lake this way, and the girls walked around the lake that way, and I passed off a note. And 28 days later, we fell in love. We never had a conversation. But all of a sudden that night, she gave me a note. And I was like, please, it's all good. I think I can do this thing called recovery. No problem. Right? And I pass a note, and my counselor, Mark, he wants me to come in and do step one. Now, I could recite chapter 5 when I was a kid, so he wanted me to do step one. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol. My life's unmanageable, sir. Absolutely. And he's like, looks at me, he's like, wow, man, this kid's getting it. You know, and I'm writing the notes, and I can tell you how step two worked in my life at that time. He wanted me to come in and do step two. Well, that day I wrote her a note, and that afternoon when she was supposed to give me a note, she didn't give me a note that day. All of a sudden, I was pissed. I was angry. I lost all hope. Oh, my God, she doesn't like me. Got super sad because I'm sensitive, you know. And that morning, all of a sudden, she gave me a note, and I was like, bling, I was happy. I was like, man, recovery, here we go. I was ready to do this thing. And Mark called me into the office, and he said, you need to, you know, come to Believe. I said, oh, I'm believing. I didn't tell him it was in her, but that's what was going on, right? Next week, he wanted me to do step three. Or 2 weeks later, he wanted me to do step three. The next week, he told me, you got to do a nine-month program. I thought that was pretty extreme, 9 months, you know what I mean? So I wrote my girl a note. She's like, oh, my God, I got to do a nine-month program, too. I'm thinking, this is God's will right here. She's got to do a nine-month program. I got to do a nine-month program. I'm like, where should we go? She's like, let's go to Hawaii. I'm like, romance, too, right? Now, I grew up pretty close to the ocean. I've surfed one time in my life. I fell, hit my head. I've never liked the ocean since. But I figured I could go to Hawaii and become one, you know, one with the ocean and find God, you know, with my new love. So he wanted me to come in. I said, oh, I'm turning my will and life right over to her. I got coined out most likely to succeed guy. You know, I was like a little junior counselor in there. They're like, oh, my God, you're going to do so good. And I got on the plane, and the stewardess asked me what I wanted to drink. See, I was in Betty Ford as a heroin addict. Alcohol wasn't my problem. And if you're not alcoholic, a Heineken sounds just about right. And I remember bringing me that Heineken. It was warm. It wasn't even cold. I didn't say, hey, can I, you know, can you make it? I didn't care. I put that Heineken back, and 12 or 13 Heinekens later, I landed in Hawaii. Right? And I got off the plane in Hawaii, and I stood there, and there was sober living on the left, and there was a bar on the right. I thought about the sober living, and I thought about the bar, and I thought about the sober living. All of a sudden, the bar was like, blah, 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 blah. It was like shiny. I mean, all of a sudden, there was a live band in there. Looked at the sober living, it's getting more dull. Just, oh, there's like 300 or 400 people dancing in there. Man, that bar is looking good, man. I said, I'll go to sober living tomorrow. And I walked in that bar, and I walked up to the bar, and I ordered another drink. I remember putting that drink around. There wasn't anyone in the bar. There was no band. There was no one dancing, you know. There was one dude with no teeth, you know. And I knew at that moment that I'd given up my chance for recovery. I knew at that moment that I was alcoholic. But I lost the power of choice. And the book talks about, right, to live by spiritual principles or die an alcoholic death, these aren't easy choices for us. And I stood there that day and I thought about it. Sober living. And I walked in the bar and ordered another drink. And I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I was dying, I'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous and say I'm an addict, because I didn't know what alcoholism was, dying. I'd get people's numbers. And I remember blacking out one time, and I came to. I was in a bathtub. I was completely naked. I was physically and sexually assaulted. Had blood coming out of my body. I sat there that day, it came to, and I was full of shame, I was full of guilt, I was alone, I was afraid, and I looked at this door, and I knew I had to walk out to find some kind of clothing. I walked down the hallway, and I walked into the living room, there's three guys on the couch, and I saw some clothes in the corner. I kind of just grabbed them, and I put them on with my head down, just full of shame, shaking violently. I got in the elevator, I went downstairs. And there was a across the street, there was a liquor store and a payphone. I reached my hand in my pocket, and I had this guy's number from AA. And I called him. I'm like, dude, I need help. And the guy's like, I'll be there in 20 minutes. Can you make it without drinking? And I made a promise to that guy that day. I said, I promise I won't drink till you get here. And I walked in that liquor store to get a pack of cigarettes, and I walked out with a pint of tequila. I went around that liquor store, and I took off that top, and I threw that top down, and I put that tequila back. And all that shame and all that guilt, all that fear and all that loneliness went away. And I blacked out. And all of a sudden, I came to. It was dark. There was all these people like this kind of looking at me. And they're like, we want to welcome the newest newcomer to AA. And I was like, what the hell's going on? They were putting the sheet around me. This old timer's like, here's a big book of AA, you know? And I'm like, I don't want to be an AA, you know? And I was at a camp out on the North Shore. And they were pulling a pig out of the ground. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I just wanted to get back to drink more. And the guy dropped me off, and he said, can you not drink today? I made that promise to that guy. I'm not going to drink. I walked in the liquor store and I got another bottle, you know. And it took me another 2 years till I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that time, I taught my mom how to Western Union money, and you know, I'd tell her I ran, got an accident, or I bumped my head here, got stitches here, and my mom would wire me the money. You know, and when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was on 6 in Los Angeles, downtown LA. I hadn't showered in 6 months. I was 98 pounds. I was up for 21 days, roughly. Hadn't eaten in that much time. Audio and visual hallucinations. I'd see the devil and his troops. They'd follow me wherever I went. And I'd look, and the devil would be like, "You see that girl over there on the right?" And I'd look, I'd say, "Yeah." And he'd say, "Take, steal her purse and meet me 6 blocks on the right." And I'd jump the girl, I'd steal her purse, and I'd meet the devil on the 6 blocks down the right and have a full-on conversation. I stood in the corner of 6 Los Angeles, and I went, I thought I was an antenna. I thought the aliens were communicating through me to get important information from you normal folks, you know. And the book talks about our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And we can go to Skid Row tonight, and there's a guy in the corner, doing the deal. You know, I didn't push a shopping cart around. Thank God for pride. My friend did. And I thought to myself, when I have to push a shopping cart around, then I'll get sober. Right? Then it's bad when I'm pushing a shopping cart. Right? Not the fact that I had 2 shoes, only one had a sole. Right? I was looking at 3.5 years in prison. I had to do the Salvation Army program. My mom, I'd go to Salvation Army and I'd leave. Santa Monica, I was there 1 month, left. San Francisco, in there a couple weeks, left. And I'd go to jail, and I'd go to jail, and I'd go to jail on a warrant, and I'd go to jail on a warrant. And my mom would come see me in jail, and she'd look at me in the glass, and she'd say, "Just go to AA." And I'd say, "But I'm not an alcoholic." And I'd leave that jail, and I'd go to that, in Orange County, there's a 7-Eleven, and I'd walk into that, to that 7-Eleven, and I'd call a friend, and I'd walk in, I'd get a pack of cigarettes, a 12-pack of beer. And I'd walk in that liquor store, in that donut shop, and I'd put one beer down. All that fear, all that shame, that guilt, and that loneliness would go away. In the middle of the second beer, I'd have a thought that says, "I wonder what they're doing down the street." Knowing my ride's coming, I'd walk down the street, and I'd meet a new friend. And all of a sudden, we're business partners. All of a sudden, we're doing big things. And before I know it, I'm back in jail. I'm thinking, how the hell did I get here? And my mom would come see me, and she'd look at me in the glass, and she'd say, "Just go to AA." And I'd say, "But I'm not an alcoholic." And I'd get out of jail, and I'd walk in that to call for a ride, get the pack of cigarettes, 12-pack of beer, walk in that donut shop, put one beer down, all that shame, guilt, loneliness, and fear would go away. In the middle of the second beer, I'd think, "I wonder what they're doing down the street." I'd walk down the street knowing I'm waiting for my ride, knowing that I just ended up in jail last month. And I'd meet a new friend, and we'd start doing some new things. Before I know it, I'm back in jail. Now I'm getting big jumpsuits. Now I'm creasing my pants. Right? Now I'm playing the politics. Now the guard's like, "We'll see you next week, dude." And I'm like, "No way." And my mom would stop wiring me money. Right? But I manipulated her one this time to get me a motel, and that motel was on Ball and Harbor. And I was trying to get in the Salvation Army. My hustle was up. There was no hustle. My hustle would be I'd walk into a gay bar and I'd flirt with enough dudes to get enough alcohol. And hopefully I can make it out in time before I blacked out. And I'm sitting in this motel with this dude, and I had a moment of clarity. That moment of clarity took me all the way back till I was a little boy in Mission Viejo. Grew up with a lot of love, had a lot of people in his life that loved him. And I looked at my life where I was sitting that day. And at that moment, I said to myself, "I can't live this way anymore." And I called my mom and I said, "Mom, I need help." And my mom said, "You know what, I can't help you anymore. She said, if I come and help you, I'm gonna end up killing you." And my mom was going to come with a loaded gun that day. But I can guarantee you, if my mom would have came that day, I would have manipulated her for $20 more, and I guarantee you I wouldn't be sitting here tonight. And she hung up on me. I was 98 pounds. I was shaking on the end of the bed. And these two guys from AA came. And this guy had big hair. His name was Jack. He's like, my name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. You know what I mean? I was like, whoa, dude. Slow down, you know. And this other guy was on a walker. He's like, my name's John, and I'm an alcoholic, you know. And I have 90 days, you know. And I'm like, rad, dude. You know what I mean? And I can tell you, Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't attractive. I wasn't like, yippee, going to AA. But the grace of God, I don't know. All of a sudden, I stood up and I followed these two dudes downstairs. And they told me, they're like, if you need to throw up, just throw up on the floor, kid. They're like, don't worry, it's a 12-step van, you know. And I'm like, oh, rad, 12-step van, you know. They're like, you might have a 12-step van one day, you know. Oh, great. And this guy started driving, and he started telling me a story. And he talked about losing the kids, losing the wife, and losing the business. And I started to shut off to the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started talking to myself, and I said, I haven't had a business, haven't had a kid, haven't had a wife. And when I started to shut off to the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, he started talking about the way he felt when he got to AA. He talked about the shame, he talked about the fear, he talked about the guilt, and he talked about that loneliness.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And for the first time in my life, I related to another human being, because I knew that that man knew exactly how I felt on the inside. And before I knew it, I ended up at a place called Charlie Street in Costa Mesa. And they told me it was an indigent detox. I didn't know what indigent meant. They said, you're homeless, kid. And that guy Jack walked me in. He said, this is your seat. You don't ever have to give it up if you don't want to. And I had no clue what that meant. Later on that night, some guy was in my seat. I'm like, hey, dude, you're in my seat. Get out, you know. And he just looked at me, you know. And that guy Jack came that night, and he looked at me and he said, you know, he basically told me he was going to be my sponsor. You know, he didn't go, oh, go find someone that has what you want. He said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And he gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, I want you to do two things. He said, I want you to read the big book from the first page, it's blank, to 164. He says, as selfish and self-centered you are, I want you to read the Roman numerals too, you know. And the second thing I want you to do is I want you to take a shower. And I thought, how do you know I hadn't taken a shower? You know what I mean? And that guy left. And I went to my room and I got the big book and I started to read the big book. And I don't know what it was like the first time you read the big book, but it was like the Charlie Brown show. Wah, 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 wah. X, Y, you know, ticket tape, you know, musket and pot, you know. I was like, huh? Ominous? What the hell does that word mean, you know? And that guy Jack came that night, and he said, did you read the big book? And I said, I read it, but it doesn't make any sense. And he said, the first time I read the big book didn't make any sense either. And he sat down with me, and he read word for word and line for line out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was another book on the table. It was called a dictionary. And he said, when you get to a word you don't understand, I want you to look it up. And so I started to do that. And he talked about this physical allergy that when he put alcohol in his body, he couldn't stop until he ended up in institutions. We got to this part of the book where it talked about a mental obsession. It tries to control and enjoy his drinking without having any consequences. And my head started to bob. And I looked back when I was in jail, and my mom would tell me to go to AA, and I'd say, I'm just not going to do crack cocaine. I'm just not going to do heroin. I'm just going to try to, you know, I'd go to church in there. You know, I'm going to do church. You know, study the Bible. You know, go to AA. You know, read all these books. You know, do all this stuff. And I'd get out and I'd walk in that liquor store and I'd get a 12-pack of beer, and I told you what happened to me. And what happened from going through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor who told me his story and talked about his alcoholism. His alcoholism touched my alcoholism. And I identified with the physical allergy and I identified with the mental obsession. And what happened for me was the greatest gift that anyone had given me in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I became an alcoholic. And it's my opinion tonight that when I accepted that I, or surrendered that I was an alcoholic, was I then able to have the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous had to offer. Because what happened for me was I was no longer different from you. I was one amongst many. You know, see, because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, I'm a dope fiend. I separated myself. I'm a heroin addict, separated myself. I'm this, I'm that, separated myself. But when I became an alcoholic, I was one amongst many. When my sponsor looked at me and said, I want you to stack those chairs, I didn't double guess him. I said, yes, I'll do that. And I'd stack the chairs. And I'd get done with the chairs and he'd say, I want you to sweep. And I'd sweep. And then I'd mop. And that day, that guy, after that first day he came, he looked at me and he knew I didn't take a shower. He didn't say anything to me, idiot, stupid loser, smelly bum. That guy walked me upstairs. He walked me in the bathroom. And that man put me in the shower and that man scrubbed me down and bathed me. And for the first time in my life, I felt love from another human being. You know, and that love that day penetrated this wall of fear just a little bit, that I could start to trust the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that guy got me busy in service right away. He didn't, you know, I had like 5 days. He's like, see that dude back there? Guy was like, you know how we do, you know? I'm like, yeah, I see him. He's like, I want you to go talk to him. I'm like, but I don't have any yet. Why don't you talk to him? You've been sober a year and a half, you know. You got the steps, you know. And he looked at me and said, you have 5 days. That guy has no days. You know how to stay sober one day. Why don't you go talk to that guy? And I'd go talk to that guy. And then he would tell me that I'm the greeter at the meeting, right? The big speaker meeting in Laguna, 250 people, you know. I'm like, I'm the awkward guy in right field. I don't want to stand at the greeting line, you know. I'm like, well, what do I say? He's like, you just say your name's Pat. You're an alcoholic. You don't know shit. I'm like, all right. Hi, I'm Pat. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know shit. Ha, ha, ha. Hi, I'm Pat. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know. Ha, ha, ha. You know, all of a sudden, you know, Jonathan's bringing his sponsees over. Oh, you got to meet this guy. You know, hi, I'm Pat. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know shit. Ha, ha, ha. You know. Meeting gets done. I'm stacking chairs, right? All of a sudden, I'm being a service around Alcoholics Anonymous. I start to realize you guys, right, or getting girlfriends, you guys are going bowling. I'm pissed off that you didn't invite me to go bowling, you know. I don't want to go anyways, but I'm pissed off, you know. And so I go up to my sponsor. I'm like, why do I got to do all this, you know, slave labor work? And my sponsor looked at me square in the eyes. He said, son, he said, your whole life you've been a taker. He said, what we're going to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous is turn you into a giver. And I wasn't like, oh, whoopee, you know. But that's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me today, is it's turned me into a giver. I learned how to have relationships from being of service. Right? Because you're standing at the greeting line, right? And all of a sudden, Connie's like, hey, what's your name? And I'm like, my name's Pat. You know, awkward guy, you know. Then the next week, I show up, and Connie's like, hey, Pat, how are you doing? And I remember what it felt like that Connie remembered my name. And I'd tell her all my woes about wherever I was or whatever's going on. And she would tell me her woes, and I didn't really care, but I felt like obligated to listen, you know. The next week I'd show up and Connie would say, hey, Pat, how's all the woes that I listed the week before? And I remember what it felt like that she remembered a little bit about my life. And then all of a sudden I would say the same thing to her. How were your woes from the week before? And I started to learn how to care about people through the process of being of service. You know, and I'm not a God guy. To be honest with you, I didn't believe in God until I had 8.5 years of sobriety. But my sponsor would tell me every day, get on your knees and pray. Pray in the morning and pray at night. And I'm like, well, I feel like I'm talking to bed sheet. He's like, all right, instead of saying God, just say bed sheet. So I started doing that. Every day I'm praying in the morning, I'm praying at night. Praying in the morning, praying at night, right? I'm sponsoring guys. And I'm active, involved in Young People's and Alcoholics Anonymous. And AA boy meets AA girl on AA campus. There's some of those going on here tonight. And they also have AA babies. And I can tell you, if it was up to me, I'd have shortchanged myself. I don't know how you guys are in relationships, but I'm horrible. I get in a relationship, right, and I get afraid. Right? I'm terrified. And so I end the relationship. So I'm fucking awkward guy. And then all of a sudden, she's like, you know, because healthy relationships, all of a sudden you get back together, you know. And she all of a sudden says, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, no, you're not. Let's do X, Y, Z, get rid of that thing, you know. She's like, no, I'm keeping it. And we're going to my sponsor, you know what I mean? He's like, dude, you're going to go to every doctor's appointment. You're going to suit up and you're going to show up. I start doing that. You know? Then there was a little complication, which started therapy for 15 months because of my actions. My friends are laughing at me. If you want to know what it is, come talk to me after. I'd love to talk to you about it. I got some good experience. But I was going to every doctor's appointment, every, you know, Facebook, delete people. You know how the drama goes, you know, and some of them are here, you know. But you forget one, and then they have all the juice on you. You know, it's AA drama, you know what I mean? And anyway, so therapy, doctor's appointment. All of a sudden, I'm in the labor room, my son being born, and my mom's there. She's taking pictures, you know. It's just weird, you know. It's already weird anyways to be in the labor room, you know, and I'm holding her hand, and my mom's in there taking pictures, and the doctor's like, oh, my God, this would be a great picture. And I'm like, oh, hell no, you know what I mean? And I don't know what happened. I don't know if the doctor did something. I don't know if my son did something. I don't know if God did something. But all of a sudden, my son came out, and I looked right into the eyes of God. Now, if you're new, my message isn't go have babies and find God. That's not the message. But what happened for me that day was I looked right into the eyes of God, and there was no denying that there was a God. You know, and for the first 6 months, I got to take care of that little boy because I was a full-time student. And you know what I mean? I'm like, you know, I don't even have a dad. How am I supposed to be a dad? You know, and my son, his name's Eden, and he liked to sit on my head, or at least I thought he did. I don't know, you know. I remember one time he got the hiccups. I called everybody. Oh, he has the hiccups. What do I do? They're like, I don't know. What do you do when you have the hiccups? I'm like, wait it out. They're like, great, you know. And, so I'm sitting on the computer, and my son's sitting there, you know. He's 6 months old, and I stand up, and I put him on my head because he likes to be on my head, and I put his head right into a ceiling fan. I was like, whack, whack, whack. You know what I mean? And my sponsee was there, and I must have looked green because he was like, you know, and I'm like, here, take him, you know. And I go to the back room, and I get on my knees, and I'm praying to this God I don't believe in. Because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me to pray every morning and pray every night. Right? If you're resentful of someone, pray for him. Right? If shit goes down, pray for it. I didn't believe in God, but I did the action because that's what people told me to do in AA. And I got to the back room, and I get on my knees. I'm like, God, what do? I just put my son's head in the ceiling fan, you know? And I had this deep down intuition that was like, why are you talking to me? Call the doctor. Like, fucking brilliant, you know what I mean? Dude, I'm looking around. I'm thinking, is someone talking to me? You know, call the doctor. He tells me what to do. I grab my kid. I look at him. You know, his eyes aren't weird. You know, he's not sleeping, you know? And I'm like, all right, he's okay. And what happened? For the first time in my life, I cared more about another human being than I cared about myself. You know, all of a sudden, shortly after that, that relationship ended, you know, and I'm sensitive, real sensitive. I'm also really dramatic, right? I'm like, kill myself dramatic. I remember I'm like, I'm going to get loaded. I'm going to go, I'm going to pray to my kid. Right? I'm on the knees in his room praying, and I didn't get loaded, thank God, but that relationship ended, and then I got in another relationship, and because of my brilliant actions, that relationship ended, right? And I'm driving my car down a 45-mile-an-hour road, pushing the gas pedal as fast as I can, because I'm waiting for enough cars on the left-hand side to barrel my car into the oncoming traffic and kill myself. And I had this intuition, this inside, said, why don't you call that guy Jonathan from your Tuesday night meeting before you kill yourself? I was like, where did that come from? I'm like, don't you know I want to kill myself? And so what happened was I picked up the phone and I called this guy Jonathan. It was 11:30 at night. This dude's like 55, and I thought he's sleeping. And he answers, Pat? I'm like, oh, shit, he answered, you know? I'm like, yeah, I'm crying, you know, suicidal, I'm going to kill myself. And he's like, oh my God, he lit up like a chandelier, was so happy. Oh my God, I've been waiting for this call for a year. You know what I mean? And I'm like, fucking glad you were, you know. And I tell him everything that's going on, and what he says on the other end of the line, he says, you know what, Pat, what I want you to do is I want you to meet me at Denny's on off El Toro on the 5 freeway. And I said, all right, cool, man, I'll meet you there. And that man knew I wasn't going to show up. He said, no, I'm going to stay on the phone with you until you get to Denny's. And that guy stood on the phone with me and talked to me and talked to me, and I pulled up to Denny's, and he pulled up to Denny's. 11:30 at night, that guy with 29 years of sobriety, right? That guy stayed on the phone with me, and he drove 35 miles to meet me. And what happened was that guy pulled out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he turned to page 52. And he started to read the bedevilments, right? We were prey to misery, we were prey to problem. I'm like, yeah, couldn't be of real use to anyone. Yeah. And I'd come to AA and I'd share it with people and they'd go, how's your program? You're right where you're supposed to be. Nothing happens in God's world by mistake. You know, I'm like, fuck you, you know? That guy didn't say those one-liners to me. What that guy did was he looked at me, he said, what looks like neurosis? Crazy? He's like, what you're suffering from is untreated alcoholism. The reality is your God isn't big enough. You're out here sponsoring all these guys, active and young people, doing the do. That's good. And I looked at him, I started crying. I said, I don't believe in God. You know? If I go back to that relationship, what happened was before that, when my son's mom and I broke up, I was doing a fifth step with my sponsor at the time in the back of my home group, my original home group, and I looked at him and he said, "What's your biggest fear?" And I said, "My biggest fear is that I'm afraid to be alone." And he looked at me and he said, "The underlying fear of that is that you're really afraid that there is no God." He said, "The underlying fear of that is that you're really afraid to die alone." I was crying and I had to say this prayer, God, I don't believe that you exist. Will you please show me? Every day I'm praying, God, I don't believe that you exist. Will you please show me? And all of a sudden I got a call from an ex-girlfriend of mine I used to get loaded with. And she said, Pat, she said, I just found my sister hung from the rafters. Will you please come help me? And because Alcoholics Anonymous told me to always say yes, I said, yes, I'll be right there. And I drove to her house and I didn't know what to say and have the magic words. Right, but I just went there and I started to be of service and I started cleaning the house and I went grocery shopping and I cleaned her mom's room and I cleaned her room and I was doing all this service work and I'm cleaning and I'm grocery shopping and all of a sudden I ran out of service. And I went to the backyard and I was praying to that God I didn't believe in. I said, God, I don't know what to do. And I said that prayer in the morning, God, I don't believe that you exist. I completely forgot about the prayer and all of a sudden this hummingbird right in front of my face, literally, you know, and I looked at this hummingbird, and I was like, all right, I believe, you know, and I called my sponsor, and I said, at the time, I said, Tom, I said, the reality is I don't believe in God, I just saw this hummingbird, I think God's here, maybe, and we started to process, we started to talk, and what came out was that I believed in God, but I didn't feel that I was worth God's love, and he said, you have to say a prayer every day, God, I believe you exist, but I don't believe that I'm worth your love. I'm saying this prayer, and I'm in this training, and all of a sudden this lady's talking about fear, paralyzing fear, and I identify, and this lizard walks across the circle, these people walk across this way, and this lizard freezes, you know what I mean? It's like, and she looks, and she goes, you see that lizard? That's fear. And I identify with that paralyzing feeling. And all of a sudden my friend's hitting me, she's hitting me, I'm like, what? Stop hitting me. She points at my leg, and this lizard walked up my leg, and it sat on my leg right here, and it looked at me, and I looked at it. And I figured that if that lizard trusted me, that maybe God loves me this much. And then I was like, dude, get off my leg, you know what I mean? Because I don't like lizards, you know? And I slowly started to believe in something. But when I'm sitting there with that guy and he's talking about untreated alcoholism, I started to cry because I knew that I was dying of the disease of alcoholism. But I had hope. And I started to go through the steps with this guy again. And in step two, what happened for me was I had to look at these capitalized words. I had to look at the prejudices I had towards God. Right? I knew when he talked about God, you were talking about Jesus. Right? I'm the guy in Skid Row that good church people would bring me food, and I would throw the apple at them, and I could tell them where they'd go with their God, and I'd kick over their signs. I thought that if there was a God, why would he take my dad? If there was a God, why would he have my mom kick me out? If there was a God, why would this, why would that, why would this? And I had all these prejudices, and I had to set those prejudices aside. He didn't say get rid of them. He said just set them aside, right, and ask intuitively what God is for me. And I started to create this God, and I had to look at what a vision of sanity was for me. I know what insanity is. I've been living it my whole life. I started to write that this vision of sanity and what that looks like in my life. And then I had to write a list of the things that were standing in the way of me having a better relationship with God. My ego, what people think of me, being right. And I had to say a prayer, God, please take away the things that stand in the way of me having a better relationship with you. And I went to sleep and I woke up and I crossed all these things out. And I got on my knees with this man and I did a third step with this man. I made a decision to turn my will and life over to this God that I believed in. I'm crying with this guy. I'm just bawling, crying. You know. I had to do a ninth step with this guy, and I had to make amends to my dad. And I had to make amends to God. And a mom, how do you make amends to a man you never met? And I'm on my knees in my office, and I'm making amends to my dad. Because I used that man to get what I wanted. If you had my life, you'd drink too, you know. And I manipulated people using my dad, and I'm on my knees, and I'm making amends to my dad. And I had this deep intuition that says you need to focus on things like family. You need to focus on things like your career so that you can provide for. I'm doing a 10th step with my sponsor, and I'm sitting there, and my sponsor has me write these two fears. And I had the two fears left. I had this fear that I was never going to connect to another human being, and I wasn't financially going to ever be successful. And I look at my sponsor, and he looks at me, and he says, I hear two things. What I hear you say is that you never had anyone in your life show you how to live, and the second thing is you've never had anyone in your life to tell you that they believe in you. And I started to break down. This man came, and he put his arm around me, and he said, I believe you, and I love you. And he said, do you mind if my wife comes in? I said, yeah, that's fine. She came in and she put her arm around me and they're both holding me and they pulled me close to him. She starts telling me what he thinks of me and what I mean to him. You know. Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot more than just not drinking. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't want to feel shame and guilt and fear and loneliness anymore. And I've been given a big life in Alcoholics Anonymous. My son is the absolute best thing in my life. Yeah, next to my sobriety. He's pissing me off right now, but that's all right. It's my issue. I love that little boy more than life itself, you know. And you know, I get asked to speak sometimes, you know, and I end with this story because I always end with it. But I got asked to speak in Taylorsville, California, and I was always taught to say yes. It was like 6 months before I got asked to speak, and I just said, yeah, I'll be there, just remind me. And I don't know if you know where Taylorsville, California is, but it's a 10-hour drive, and it's camping. I wanted to pack my cardboard box, you know what I mean? I know I set one of those up, you know, but I bought a tent, right, because I'm a big camper guy. And we get in the car, and I realize I have them because I have them half and half every other weekend. And the girlfriend that I'm with at the time is in the car, you know, we have DVDs set up, and we're about an hour in, and his name's Eden Gannon Ochoa for all you acronym folks, but all of a sudden, now we're in, he's like, hey, Dad, he's like, what's that out the window? I'm like, oh, that's a tractor, son. I'm really all happy, joyous, and free, excited for this camping trip. 2 hours in, he's like, hey, Dad, can you put the DVD in? I'm like, yeah, no problem, son. I'd love to put the DVD in for you. 4 hours in, he wants to know what's outside. I'm like, I told you an hour ago what's outside. 5 hours in, he wants me. I'm like, put the DVD in yourself. Can't you tell I'm driving? 9 hours in, he wants to know what's outside. I'm just ignoring his ass. Right? Restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm angry. There's no prayer. Right? I'm pissed. I'm ignoring him. 36 years old, ignoring him. He's 4, ignoring me. All of a sudden, we get to Taylorsville, California. And if you've been to Taylorsville, California, you know what I'm talking about. It's a lake in the middle of nowhere, right? You turn your iPhone on, right? It says searching. There's no call your sponsor. There's no app, spot check inventory, you know? I get out of the car to set the tent up. I get bit by like 50 mosquitoes, you know? And I'm like fucking pissed. I grab my kid. I throw him in the tent. I'm like, go to bed. I'll build a tent around you. I go to bed, I get on my knees, and I pray to a God I don't believe in. Because AA taught me to always pray at night and review my day. And I'm on my knees, and I'm praying, and I had this intuition that said, you treated that boy that was out of disrespect and out of anger, and you owe that little boy an amends. You know, and there wasn't like call your sponsor and check it out. And I'm grateful for sponsorship that's always guided me back to God. And that next morning I woke up and I said, Eden, I go, you want to go on a walk? He's like, yeah, I'd love to go on a walk. You know, super excited, 4 years old, you know, and he totally forgot. But I didn't forget. And I went on with that little boy, walked up this path. We got to a tree and I got on my knees because I was taught that all I am to that boy is a spiritual guide for that little boy to find his own relationship with God. I'm no better than him, and I'm not greater than him. And I looked him in the eyes. I said, son, I said, I just want to say that I treated you in a way yesterday. I don't appreciate treating you anyone. And I treated you out of disrespect, and I treated you out of anger. And I just want you to know that I'm sorry. My little boy looked at me in the eyes. He said, Dad, he said, it's okay. He's like, everybody makes mistakes. 4-year-old. I wanted to ask him to be my sponsor, you know what I'm saying? I have a sobriety date. It's October 23rd, 2002. I have a home group, and it's called the Outright Mental Defectives Group, and it's the best home group ever. And if your home group's not the best home group ever, get a job in that home group. And if it's still not, you better find another home group. Because the guys in my home group have saved my ass day in and day out. And I have a sponsor, and his name's Jonathan C., and I'm forever grateful for that man, you know. And if you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to let you know that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot more than just not drinking. It's about growing up around here. And I'm grateful. My sponsor says, go out and scrape your keys. He tells me to go out and scrape your knees, kid. Go out and make mistakes. Right? Because when I make mistakes, I get the opportunity to grow, and I'm forever grateful. Thank you.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.